Welcome to the FuturePod Spotlight Series on the APF IF Awards for 2023. In 2022, the APF changed from the Most Significant Futures Work Awards to the IF Awards. Let's hear from Maggie and John what the IF Awards are all about.
The awards served as an invaluable resource for pointing clients and the future's curiosity towards understanding the nature of work. IF questions, what if X, then Y, are central to what we do as curators, facilitators, and researchers in supporting communities, organizations, and institutions to explore the futures.
In celebration of the APF's 20th anniversary, MSFW was reimagined as the APF IF Awards to reflect the globality, diversity, transdisciplinarity of the organization and the futures and foresight field. The reimagined IF Awards program recognizes the evolving excellence in futures and foresight work with an emphasis on key thematic areas such as impact, imagination, and indigenous.
Those awards are done and dusted, and now we are here to celebrate the winners and special mentions. So get ready to hear from people doing important futures and foresight work all over the globe that is innovative, inclusive, indigenous, and much, much more. So on with the show. Okay, Maggie, who have we got next?
We have another imaginative project winner, and it's each one of the imaginative projects is thrilling. This one has an extra element of surprise and cheerfulness to it. It's called Envisioning Climate Futures Through Everyday Artifacts. This interactive installation, Signs of Change, turns abstract futures into accessible platforms with imagined public signage depicting future impacts of climate change. It turns global climate issues into relatable human-scale events and scenarios. And I'm going to add the word whimsy in there too. Signs represents potential policies, etiquette, values across different locations and timescales for collective meaning-making about climate impacts and value shifts. The judges unanimously recommended this project for the IF Award, praising its innovative and accessible approach to promoting futures literacy through thought-provoking public signage and installations across four continents. They commended the project's clever blend of foresight methods, public art, and community engagement, crediting an inclusive dialogue around potential futures in a playful yet impactful way. The universal language of signage made the concepts understandable to diverse audiences unfamiliar with future studies. Overall, the judges celebrated this highly scalable and compelling effort to make futures thinking engaging and participatory for the general public. What I think is cool about it is that it led to developing assessment tools for evaluating speculative signage. And we don't often measure the impact of design fiction. So I'm going to come back to this one when I think about how did we do.
Welcome to FuturePod Radical Norms, winners in the APF's IF Awards for 2023 in the category of imaginative.
Thank you for having us.
Hello.
Daniel, so, start with you. Radical Norms, who are you? Who's involved in this, and what was the piece of work leading up to that you got involved in?
Mm-hmm. Radical Norms, actually, Signs of Change, the project that we were awarded for, is a collaboration between Radical Norms, a speculative design studio based in Toronto, who is here on the call, myself, Daniel, Angelica, and Kobe, and also a very close friend and collaborator, Bettina Schwalm, she's a design strategist based out of Stockholm. And we've been collaborating for a while, and I met Bettina when we were doing our grad studies in Stockholm. She was doing experience design, I was doing storytelling, and brought her onto the team. From there, Signs of Change blossomed and flourished. But before that, Signs of Change started during Design TO, which is Design Toronto. It's an offsite, now an official design festival here in Toronto. We popped up as Signs of Change, as a project under Radical Norms. And the main essence was, how can we make futures and foresight methods more accessible to the general public?
Yep.
And so we were in this shipping container. There was a called Stacked Market at the time. It's still around, which is a bunch of shipping containers stacked on top of each other. And every shipping container had another, a little world unto itself of somebody doing something in it. And we were one of those shipping containers. And we popped up with these then wooden signs with a vinyl cutter. And we created a bunch of signs that were exploring the future of Toronto from different perspectives, whether it was related to tech disruptions, climate crisis, new ways of living, new behaviors in relation to these disruptions we were seeing. Created these signs, invited people to stop by. We would have conversations. From there, we started to build and respond to people's responses to the signs that we were showing. That's where it all began. And we held a workshop. That workshop was, again, trying to envision new futures of Toronto, taking them through a process of foresight, making it as simple as possible, and then manifesting more signs from it. And then from there, it went dormant until we brought Bettina on board, and she brought us into this open call that was being done by Vinnova, the Swedish innovation arm. They have a very strong feeling about speculative design and how it can inform innovation processes, where they were asking different people to present their work and signs of change. We formalized it with Bettina and pitched it, got some funding for it, and then expanded it. This sort of literal what if idea to something that let's take this serious. Let's try and see what happens when this doesn't just pop up once, but pops up many times. So we popped up in Stockholm, and we'll get into that, but we ended up popping up in many different places. We started in Stockholm. We went to Palo Alto, and we went to Singapore. We did some signs in Israel, and there's a few more other places, but that's essentially where it began.
The thing I see with this kind of work, and I go back to the seminal work of Stuart Candy and Jake Dungan in Hawaii when they were putting the blue line where the sea level was going to rise, what I call guerrilla foresight, of where you actually confront people, ambush them with a future that they've never, ever thought of, is a very different way to do foresight when we invite people in with this lovely, seductive notion that they can build the future. You're almost coming from the other side of where you actually get slapped across the face by the future.
We're designers, first and foremost. I wouldn't say we're traditionally foresight practitioners, but we leverage foresight tools and methodologies to inform the things that we design. And design for us is a tangible practice. It's something where we create objects, and objects exist in space, and you are confronted by them, and therefore you need to react to them. And I think that's where there's beautiful synergy happening when you have design or speculative design, narrative building, future making, making objects and prototypes merge with foresight practice, where you have a methodical approach to unpacking and the layers of future. And you merge these together, and all of a sudden you have something that is steeped in research and insight and foresight, but manifests in something very tangible. These archetypes that make these concepts resonate, because we're contracting the distance from now until future. Future isn't a state of becoming anymore. Future has come.
Yep.
It is here. And that's where I think the signs, that's why it resonates.
Yep. There's also an aspect of implementation. So a lot of times we're dealing with the strategic foresight. We're on a very top level, almost like a bird's eyes view. And the idea is, yeah, we can make new policies, we can develop new rules and laws and things like that. But the difference is, how do you implement those things? And what does it mean for me when if the House of Parliament came up with this amazing initiative, what does it mean for me when I'm getting out of the house and I'm starting to walk my kid to school? What happens when I'm getting a new type of insurance? It really goes into those resolutions, which in the end of the day, this is what people or a normal person would care about. and that's all. That's where we feel it's very impactful in that sense. We learn so much every time we're presenting those things just by those reactions. So it's more than, I think for me, at least, it's like with signs of change, it's more than just you get slapped in the face with the future. but you get slapped with a phage with 20 futures, and then you're completely right in your own world, and you're almost choosing what would you like from those 20 events and things that are happening, and what kind of like path would you take between those signs and those changes.
Angelica, can you tell us more about the Signs of Change project and particularly what parts you focused in on?
Coming from bridging foresight and innovation with design, for us, the decision-making around what is the most impactful and accessible artifact that lands this future to the audience, and in our first iteration, it was the public, the general public, is a big consideration in the work that we are doing. So it could have been a lot of different artifacts from products, services to systems, but we chose signs deliberately because A, there is a layer of authority in them, the layer of policy making in there. There is a layer of guiding behavior in the public, and signs are interpreted in different cultures differently. They hold different meaning. In some cultures, they are more like general guidelines, and in some countries, they are followed to the dot and are very part of everyday culture. For us, it allowed us to distill down all the trends, big drivers, small signals that we found in a format that is A, accessible, and immediate, and is universally understood. And that lifts foresight out of the report and the written word and into the public realms, opens up for interpretations, and hence the signs of change as in foresight manifested nicely in the signs of change in our everyday life and manifested in street signs.
Yeah.
Also, the craft of sign making, or in our first iteration, we actually popped up as a sign making shop where people would create their futures and like through a workshop process that is deeply informed by foresight methods. The question was, where would you put the sign? What does it communicate? To who does it communicate? And it gave a sense of agency, A, that I can shape the future, I can shape policy, and I'm becoming an activist and I hold agency from my 9-year-old son that wanted to have special crossing for robots, to someone that comes from a background at the time in 2020, it was a big discussion here in Toronto around the Google Sidewalks Lab and the private ownership of public land and all the surveillance data structure that would come. This was top of mind for a lot of people and ran through and manifested in these signs. What do we want here? What do we not want here? How do we alert people of entering a highly data surveillanced zone in a public space? That for us, why we chose signs was, for any speculative designer, is a very big decision in what it activates, how it activates, and how it can or invite people to the future making. It's not something that is residing in a gallery. No, we want to have it in the public space. We want to have it activated in also an organization. There's various levels of science that we see and surround us that allow us to play to these different spaces and behaviors that are occupied in that landscape of everyday behavior guided through norms, policies, and so forth.
The sign is an artifact that wants to evoke a social response from the viewer. And the power of the sign is either to mandate how you will behave or to give you a piece of information that you will make a wise choice of your behavior. And that's a very interesting way to explore the future, because to some extent, we see the future as open, but the sign itself is signifying that maybe the future's not as open as you thought it might be.
Yeah. And it's also this change and shift in behaviors in relation to that is what is so interesting for us, and that brings in this mundane, and that brings in how we as people move in possible futures. Yeah, so this really strong current that runs throughout all our work, I think. But yeah, you stated super well.
So how did you make these signs?
From 2020 and 2022, we developed this or streamlined this process where we first go through, it depends on the context and the place and the participants or audience that we're going to have, doing a very basic secondary research. Then we interview some experts and we extract the biggest changes, very transformative issues. You know, after we define a big shift in values that will happen. So we're going to move from a society that really value A to a society that value B, a society that values security to a society that values something completely different. As soon as we have this definition, we're trying to ground it in a specific situation. Sometimes it's going to be related to something, an economical issue. Sometimes it will be related to a social issue. Something that also came up with the questionnaire that we usually do after the project, there's this lens, social justice, that always underline everything that we're doing and will always try to look at who's not being heard. The signs are very much adjusted to the local language of signage. So we did ones for Stockholm, so everything looked like the city of Stockholm. We work with the manufacturer from the Stockholm municipality. We work with Singapore, same thing, three languages. In Israel, suddenly also the signs became very political and very divisive in a way. And with the states, like very, yeah, same thing, like very various neighborhoods. It's really interesting to see how each one of those workshops is becoming a thing by itself. And even the same sign might work very differently or might be seen very differently in every place. So I think that's in relation to how the signs are like being made.
And can someone talk about what they saw or what you learned through the use of the signs and how people engaged with them?
I think we all have our own different experiences because not everyone goes to each location. Just budget-wise, it's not possible. The common denominator has been Bettina, who's gone to each and every one of these, and then it's another one of us that accompanies. So I could speak to the Singapore experience. We present usually 10-ish different signs, which, as Kobe said, are developed with local knowledge and local stakeholders. And the 10 signs never resonate. It's usually 2, maybe 3 that really pop out, whether it's like a hot button topic or it's something that maybe is, for instance, in Singapore, social currency was really big. Another one was to do with regulated climate, which had to do with geoengineering, where there was a lot of discussion around the manipulation of climate in the area for various political reasons, altering precipitation, and what it means to have agency even over your own natural climate systems. Depending on where we popped up in, really hit the mark. It's pretty tied to 2 or 3 different signs out of the 10.
If you ran these workshops again, you would be designing a set of signs researched based on what you find out about the place and people. But as much as possible, mm-hmm. you're trying to get a spread of what? Technologies, social values, hot button news. How do you set the spread?
It first started primarily as climate disruptions. That was the thing. That's the undertone. And it started to get into different technologies, whether it's mixed realities or algorithms. And then there starts to become overlaps when you start to see technologies become things that aren't maybe enablers of just living life, but become a currency. And so it starts to challenge how we exchange value. What is value? What are new markets that might be built on the backs of these technologies that weren't obvious in the beginning, but now could be so, just depending on how we start to see different applications emerge. Climate, tech, because that touches pretty much everything, right? I think that's pretty much the red thread.
Where to next? There's certainly a workshop and a process here to really bring this notion of design artifacts and crystallize it to help people anticipate futures.
I think the nice thing that we're discovering now about signs of change and the way it's being used is that there are a lot of different ways of using it. The first one is education. It's future literacy, strategic literacy, and so on, giving a way for people to understand those methods and this way of thinking and fire and so on. Then there's the very commercial use of it. We're helping companies break through a very rigid way of thinking about the future, thinking 4 years forward and with the current rules and anchors, and really step out. And sometimes it's coming outside of the company that helps. Science of Change also has this very big collection of science from all over the world. So we immediately see how things are looking in a lot of different way, a lot of different places. And the third is policy and implementation of policy that really helps companies that are thinking about change or thinking about transformation, like to really understand or at least have another layer of understanding what that actually means. Of course, there's the cultural thing of just like spread it through the world and have as many people just trying to think and get mad and get super excited or happy, and which is kind of another very interesting kind of like quality that this project has in the public domain.
Awesome. On behalf of the APF, again, congratulations for producing one of the most significant pieces of futures work for 2023 in the category of ingenuity. And also thanks for spending some time with FuturePod.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast. FuturePod is a not-for-profit venture. We're able to do podcasts like this one because of our patrons, like Kieran Murray. Kieran has been a patron since our start. Thanks for the support, Kieran. If you'd like to join Kieran as a patron of the pod, then please follow the Patreon link on our website. Now back to the podcast. Okay, Maggie, who's our next guest?
Up next, Ben Holt and the team received an honorable mention for envisioning future humanitarian aid. This strategic foresight initiative is a practical application of foresight to frontline humanitarian programming as requested by the Red Cross National Societies in Zambia, Malawi, and Kenya. This group recognized that the future held new challenges and opportunities which could fuel innovation for a portfolio of future-ready systems-level innovations. You will hear how they combine systems mapping, strategic foresight, and design thinking in a highly inclusive creative process with local communities, experts, entrepreneurs, and academics. This creative process embedded foresight capabilities to ultimately transform global programming, increasing community resilience and dignity. The judges appreciated this project's integration of foresight methods to tackle complex humanitarian problems. They praise practical application of foresight skills towards ambitious relief outcomes and the use of systems mapping for interventions.
Welcome to FuturePod, Ben.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Firstly, Ben, congratulations for your special nomination for work of you and your team envisioning the future of humanitarian aid, innovating food security through foresight. Well done. Ben, the Red Cross Red Crescent is a massive organisation. And do you want to maybe just talk about how you and your academy sits in this massive global organisation and provides a suite of services to Red Cross Red Crescent?
Yeah, so as you say, it's a big, complex, sprawling organization. It works in 191 different countries. And in those countries, the national societies are providing services. They are working as an auxiliary to government, and they are mobilizing volunteers and staff from their own communities. They're from those countries largely. They work with communities. They build services and respond to the needs and challenges there. But then there's also the need to collaborate, coordinate, share globally. So we have the Secretariat, which is what most people would call the IFRC, so the International Federation. That's actually a kind of catch-all for all of these different national societies. But the Secretariat sits there to connect, to collaborate, to share across this network. And then the Solferino Academy sits as part of that central body, but we're like a little agency. So we will work across that network as needed and at the request of those national societies, which is great because people come to us kind of with ideas, with challenges, with questions, and they actively want us to work with them to help unpick that and find new solutions, which is brilliant. We're not banging on doors asking for people to want to do new stuff. We get to work with people with brilliant ideas and lots of enthusiasm. See, I can't even speak now.
I was going to ask you about the appetite for foresight in Red Cross, Red Crescent. There will be places that love foresight and parts that just haven't got time for it, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So there is a bit of a track record with it. It has been used in pockets, and particularly it was used as part of the design of our global strategy 2030. So right. That was before my time, but it was a deeply consultative process. It spoke to thousands of people around the world. They looked at the kind of issues and the challenges that we faced as an institution, but also in the external world. And that lent heavily into foresight, landed very well, woke a lot of people up to the potential, but was focused on producing that global vision.
Yeah,
I came in and really I was tasked with kind of picking up the legacy of that and expanding it, making it an ongoing, usable and useful capability for the network. And like you said, there are some people who are usually skeptical. There are some people who really buy into it. And we've been trying to build that momentum by raising awareness, by working on some very tricky, practical, like classic humanitarian issues. So working with the Ukraine crisis, for example, and then also on this food security program, and then also helping to train and build capacity and then connect, because there's already pockets. There's people doing some amazing stuff around our network and they might not know about each other. Kind of part of the beauty of sitting in that central agency type role is to be able to connect stuff, not to be telling, to be learning, to be sharing, to be going, oh, you guys should speak to these guys because you're both approaching the same problem from different angles.
Yeah.
So yeah, the appetite is growing and I see more and more demand for it as part of organizational change programs, thinking about how we might transform to really make sure that our principles and our services are going to be fit for the challenges that we face in coming years.
You mentioned that you're a little bit over halfway through the 2030 vision, and that is that the Academy and you are involved in that kind of midpoint assessment as to where the strategy is.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point to be at, because I think that any futures work, any good strategic foresight has to look backwards and understand the past and where it's come from and the systems and structures that we are rooted in. To understand where we might go in the future. So it's actually a really nice process to be part of. You think about the fact that Strategy 2030 came out right at the end of 2019 into 2020, and then 3 months later, COVID hit, right? Now, pandemics were mentioned in there.
Yeah,
but you know, they didn't say you've got three months.
No.
And so the process that we're going through now is twofold. We're working with our colleagues in the strategy and planning teams to analyze what's happened. So looking at how the ambitions, the transformations, the challenges that we called out in that strategy have been implemented. Have they influenced the way that our national societies are thinking, acting, planning, allocating resources? If so, like what's enabled that contextually? What's helped good change happen, or what's perhaps stymied some of those ambitions? Can we learn from that so that we can help to accelerate change or focus on the stuff that enables good change? We also need to look beyond just the kind of reporting and the strategy and the documentation of what we've done. And we need to look beyond the leaders' views of how we're doing, and to get down and to talk to and to connect with and amplify the voices of the people who are part of our global network. So within the Solferino Academy, that's a large part of our focus, is that deep connection with people all over the world, amplifying voices, listening, seeing the differences of opinion between people at different places in the organization and different points of the world. And then also looking forward, because obviously, a 10-year strategy calls out some things that may happen over those 10 years and some priorities we might need to focus on. So we need to analyze if those are still correct. do we really need to reorganize some of our change and planning? Are there new challenges that are emerging quicker that, or fresh ones that we didn't think about at the beginning of this? Sometimes it feels like a massively overwhelming process. You're looking globally over 10 years with all these different stakeholders. And sometimes it feels like a massive privilege to be able to do this.
Yeah, it strikes, given the scope of the organization, you've almost got a kind of microcosm of the world in so many respects. Given your involvement with the Cambridge Centre for Existential Risk and the IRC, is there a kind of a relationship between the work you do there and the work you do at the IRC?
Actually, the work with Cambridge has just been a kind of visiting position to go in and tap into their knowledge and connect with them and bring ideas right to them. And that's happened as I've been working for the Red Cross.
Okay.
My background's actually originally began in the humanitarian sector 20 years ago as a logistician, moving trucks, equipment, supplies around in preparation for kind of classic disaster responses. But I left the train in the media because I'd always liked writing, storytelling. I'd been fascinated by that world. And I went to do quite an old school apprenticeship with the intention of coming back into the humanitarian world with those skills. But I just happened to time it where that industry got completely sideswiped by the arrival of digital tech, changes in consumer behavior. When I started, there was a printing press in the basement and loads of people in inky overalls. And by the time I left 3 years later, that was gone. We'd been given cameras. They had this new website. And actually, that's what got me into this field of thinking about the future and how organizations do or don't prepare for it and what happens if you're not prepared. And ever since then, when I came back in, I worked for Médecins Sans Frontières for a long time, really leading through a digital lens on change and transformation, both within their kind of offices where they recruit and advocate and fundraise, but also out in their projects around the world. So Myanmar, Pakistan, South Sudan, where again, shifts in the context were massively challenging the way that they were set up to respond. And Solon did various other things, a master's in innovation and creativity. And it all came together in this role, because I've always said that what I do is evidence-based or evidence-enhanced storytelling. I'm telling people stories about the future. This might happen. We need to change like this. And here's some evidence to suggest why that's important. And then translating that into actual change in these organizations, which is really hard. And just, yeah, I was lucky that this role within the IFRC has pulled all those threads together, and it's been a real pleasure to find that space.
And digital has fundamentally disrupted the way that large organizations would operate. That once upon a time, you could imagine an organization like Red Cross, Red Crescent would have been a command and control where information was passed down. But with this notion of digital, in my experience, Ben, it's actually turned a lot of hierarchy upside down. There's actually more intelligence at the bottom of the organization and the ends of the organization than there is in the top.
Yeah, I would completely agree with you. Yes, certainly there are some very traditional hierarchical models in the past of all of these humanitarian organizations. And you know, that legacy is still there. There are some very steep hierarchies in some places. But you're right, it's impossible not to hear or be aware of or have the opportunity to connect with everybody else. For me, this is something I've always been championing in this foresight role. There's absolutely no way we should be sitting centrally telling people what the future's going to hold and the challenges they should prepare for. In fact, the opposite. I see a huge potential in the IFRC's global network to be this sensing network. Effectively, we can get right down into the real world anywhere in the world. We've got volunteers and staff working everywhere, drawn from those communities that they support. We can speak to them in real time. We can hear them. And I also think that raises another really interesting issue is that you can almost time travel within that network, because some countries are dealing with issues which will become much more prevalent and important for other countries. So how do we connect them together so that they're learning? And you're absolutely right that it flips the hierarchy and it flips the narrative. We've had some really interesting stuff, because obviously you've got like a big office in Geneva with lots of very smart people from all around the world working hard to help lead and coordinate this organization. But then there are people in different places facing and trying to deal with some challenges which are perhaps not front and center in some of those discussions, or they don't feel that they are. And that's always fascinating to hear that challenge. Like, how do you become a good support system and coordinating body without listening and having a place for those kind of ideas to surface and be challenged? Yeah, it's really important. There's huge power there, and it's untapped, really. We do it. We're trying to move towards it. We are tapping into it and building this capability, but there's a long way to go to make it super high functioning.
I was looking on your LinkedIn and I saw, and people who know me will know, the chuckle I had when I saw you'd done a survey on people's attitudes as to whether, you know, they felt agency, they felt it, they felt an ability, that they felt positive towards the future or negative towards the future. And of course, the thing I was chuckling at as we had a bit of a laugh offline was you were using Pollack game and watching people move into essence optimism and essence pessimism and all that kind of stuff. But it's a serious question there, because in that data you collected, there was this, I thought, interesting point about the optimism of people who were volunteers in the organisation relative to people who were in the organisation as, one would imagine, embedded employees. And I was struck by that because it did seem to me to be that people felt more empowered in non-Western countries than they felt in Western countries, and they felt more empowered as volunteers than they did working inside such a massive organisation. And it's a tough question, but in terms of the sort of role of digital communication, listening, why that might be?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and hugely grateful for the Pollack game, because we've done it all around the world in workshops, online, with different groups. The results you're talking about were part of this wider survey we were doing to understand people's hopes, fears, aspirations for the future. In general, I think people working in the humanitarian sector or civil society writ large, whenever I've done it, they tend towards feeling a sense of agency in general. The degree of optimism or pessimism about the future will alter quite dramatically depending, you know, on time, on place, and potentially position. But I think there's something very powerful about joining an organization like the Red Cross, Red Crescent, as a volunteer, because often you're stepping into a role within your community when you begin, right? You're doing something which is going to help people in your country around you. You're actively taking a step to engage with some of the issues that you see around you. And that can give people a real sense of purpose and space. Now, that's not to say that the volunteer model is in any way perfect. Like, it's an ongoing and deep debate about how do we keep that voluntary role relevant? How do we make sure that it's suitable for younger generations? How do we make sure that people in it are empowered to bring their ideas and their self to it, rather than just being somebody on a call list who may or may not go out and do something? I think perhaps then, if you go looking up through the hierarchy, you get tangled up in the kind of the deep, difficult, overlapping issues that these organizations are there to try and cope with, coupled with the challenges of actually making the organization function and ensure that the money is there for stuff that's needed and to protect the fundamental principles. So I know that those things can be really hard at times to unpick and very difficult to see a way through sometimes. We were actually chatting yesterday about how interesting it would be to track people's sense of optimism and agency over time within a role or within a particular thread of work. Because I think it does shift. That report that you're referring to, we've been working with various aspects of the response to the Ukraine conflict. You can see a marked difference from the people who were inside Ukraine who responded to that survey in terms of their sense of agency and optimism, obviously, right? I think the other thing that comes out when we have used this is that you often do get people saying they do feel that they have an ability to influence that future by dint of the fact that they work for an organization or volunteer for an organization like ours. But they've not necessarily always thought about what the communities they work with feel about the future? And how do they feel a sense of hope and optimism and agency over that future? And if not, how do we build that into our programs? I would genuinely think that giving people some hope for the future is a key aspect of humanitarian response work. We should be giving people a sense that things will improve. They will be safer. Their families will have space to resettle or to find security or to improve their living situation over time. But also there are people with loads of brilliant ideas genuinely trying to have an impact on the future within their community or their country or writ large. And perhaps part of what we do should be finding that and amplifying it and listening and connecting it into the resources and the space that we have. But yeah, I encourage people to keep using that activity in their own work as well.
Yeah.
It's a hugely powerful one.
I wonder too also, Ben, that Solferino Academy has three levers that you lean on. Foresight's one of them, but the other two are also important, both in terms of their own change, but also how they work with Foresight. Do you want to just talk briefly about what the other two levers of what you do are?
Sure, yeah. So we're there to help different bits of the organization as they face complex challenges, tricky problems, or they want new ways of doing stuff. So the three levers that we use are foresight, leadership, and innovation. And like you said, there's really good links and crossover between those things. I think that looking to the future, to the challenges, the opportunities, the change in context is a really powerful fuel for innovation. You need new and useful ways to do stuff in that changing world. And that's exactly what we did in this Food Security and Livelihoods program, which led to us chatting today. We connected that foresight piece to the innovation piece to come up with concepts that we think have a chance to grow, thrive, and impact that changing world over time. But for that growth and impact to happen, you need leadership buy-in as well. You have to be realistic. You're going to need resources, permission to do stuff, access to projects or people or all the rest of it. And so we work actively with leaders to understand the challenges they face, what they think the kind of leadership qualities and culture might need to be over time, and also to understand the differences globally. There's very different leadership styles in our organization. So there's been some great work done by colleagues in the team where they've been connecting leaders from different parts of the world to talk about these things openly and honestly, and then to visit each other's countries to see what's going on. And that can sometimes get lost in these big federated organizations. It's sometimes you're focused on the stuff you do, and so building those connections is really important.
One of the themes in the IF Awards that the APF put together, one of the issues that it certainly has come up in a number of the award winners and special nominations is this notion of decolonizing the future. A lot of futures concepts can be seen as an imposed thing, a Western thing based on Western values. And a number of advocates and others have been nominated and won awards for how they've tried to decolonize the future space and to truly open the space up in a massive organization like you're dealing with. This notion of opening up the future so it's not simply through the eyes of London or through the eyes of New York. Has that been another thing that you have been an active process that you've been doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very much. It's an ongoing debate within the organization writ large anyways. We said earlier, understanding where how you need to change and what the future might hold requires you to look at the past and understand where you've come from. And obviously these are institutions which are deeply rooted in a particular period of time and a particular political set of assumptions. And so there's really interesting debate going on around that across the organization. Now, given that we then work across all these countries, embedded within those countries, drawing on the communities and supporting and staffed by people from vastly different perspectives and traditions is a powerful asset that we have. The Solferino Academy itself is globally staffed. So the people that I worked with most closely on this project within my team, based in Nairobi and Abidjan, and then we were partnering with the Kenyan Red Cross, the Malawi Red Cross, and the Zambian Red Cross with other team members in Zimbabwe to ensure that the perspectives, the potential of the future was debated and discussed from very different angles, right? I was there to provide some structure, some activities, some workshops, but it was very much rooted in the ideas and the aspirations of those countries. And the work was done by those countries. So we worked in a really nicely asynchronous way where we set the framing and people went off and did their own investigations, built their own scenarios. So that's, again, us in more of the center listening and learning from what's going on there. So yeah, hugely important. And also a thread of that work that I mentioned around revisiting Strategy 2030, because that has to be something that we are looking at as an institution and in how we use Foresight and other work globally.
Ben, it's been a very brief chat, but again, I'll congratulate you for the special nomination in the APF IF Awards for Most Significant Futures Work 2023. And also to congratulate you on the work you're doing. You are in some ways modelling the future that a lot of us would hope for in managing complex issues across the whole planet. Thanks for spending some time with me and the FuturePod community.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you. And I just want to give a huge shout and support to all the people that worked on this project that we've been given the award for. They've not been able to join us today, but I've been chatting to them this week and the work's still carrying on. I feel hugely privileged to have supported the beginning of their journey, coming up with these innovation concepts, and they're taking them and running them with now. And if people wanted to find out more about how we're doing this globally, we published a book at the beginning of the year. It's called The Foresight Book. It's on the Software Reno Academy website, and that kind of captures what we've learned doing this stuff over the last few years, and it has some case studies and stuff in the back that explain how it's being applied.
Yep. Yeah, it's a good little book. I had a quick browse of it online. It's a free download. People should certainly go and grab it. Thanks again, Ben. Congratulations, and all the best in the future.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's it. We have finished the special series on the 2023 IF Award winners and mentions. I hope you enjoyed the series and found some inspiration in there. Thanks to Lisa, Maggie, and John for helping out with the series. And thanks to the APF for giving the pod the chance to feature these guests. We will return to our usual podcast now. This is Peter Hayward saying goodbye for now, and I'll see you later. I'll let John have the last word on the series. Bye.
Hi, everyone. Keep an eye out for the Association of Professional Futurists call for submissions for the IF Awards come August. If you have a futures project you're working on or considering, this is a fantastic opportunity to share it with the APF and the broader Futures and Foresight community. The IF Awards recognize excellence in futures and foresight work across 9 themes, such as impact, imagination, and indigenous. Stay tuned for insights from past winners published in Compass and the upcoming APF membership events.